Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm John Ashmore, the acting editor of CapEx. Peter Riddell is one of the country's foremost analysts of the workings of government, parliament and Whitehall. Prior to his current role as Commissioner for Public Appointments, Peter was the director of the Institute for Government and a journalist with over 40 years' experience writing for publications including the FT and The Times. He's also the author of 8 books, including 15 Minutes of Power, The Uncertain Life of British Ministers, and In Defence of Politicians, In Spite of Themselves. Our assistant editor, Frank Lawton, began by asking Peter why politicians needed defending in the first place.
Well, they need defending because they've been under attack. And in a sense, they've always been under attack. When I did my book, In Defence of Politicians, 8 years ago, this was shortly after the expenses scandal. Now, that was something egregious, but it was much more fundamental than that. I mean, the National Anthem's got a bit about the wickedness of politicians, plenty of quotes in Shakespeare, and so on and so forth. I mean, look at the cartoons of Gilray. In my office as Commissioner for Public Appointments, I got a couple of very robust cartoons, probably couldn't appear in a paper nowadays, from the early 19th century. So they've always been unpopular. But that was, in a sense, in a different culture of when it was very elite. The mob had its say, but it was the mob rather than voters. And I think what's happened is that the various things, the economic collapse in 08 onwards, the expenses scandal here, then the general rise of populism, has all fed the view of politicians as scoundrels. Both in the narrow sense of in it for themselves, financially, which is largely, not entirely wrong, and also out of touch with voters and so on. So my view was they needed defending. Partly, I believe in representative democracy rather than plebiscitary democracy. Obviously, we've now got exceptions to that, but in general. And you need politicians to do it. And most of them are decent people. And it's allied with something which has come up a lot in the last year, which is you may disagree with people, but you've got to respect their motives, and on the whole, not all entirely. And that led to the book, really. Right. And, of course, the other thing is social media and the internet has fed a culture of all politicians are scoundrels, dreadful people. I mean, you know, within 2 minutes, you and I could find something on the web saying whatever politician you name is dreadful.
Well, you mentioned the challenges to representative democracy. Do you think that those are worse now than they have been in the past, or that this is just something that is always under threat?
I think it's more under threat for two reasons. One is that they said it's a result of the lack of respect and politicians being regarded as scoundrels, the strains, and this applies, you know, and if you look at what's happened to the established parties in most large countries, it's true of their position is challenged. I think it has got worse, but it's been fed worse by the impact of social media, unquestionably, because, now, in many respects, that's great. I mean, having an open debate, one shouldn't. I mean, when I started off as a journalist, I was a political journalist, it was a very narrowly defined a political conversation. And you had very few television outlets. You had people like me as political editor, then the Financial Times, Had quite a big influence on the debate. And I think it's great it's opened up, but it's opened up in a completely unrestrained way where people aren't responsible for what they do. And that feeds this culture of challenging politicians that they're scoundrels and everything. Mm. And of course, I mean, naturally, it's been fed by Brexit and the European debate, which has produced a polarisation which again, you know, if you don't agree with me, you're a traitor. I think one problem is we move to referendums, not that that's necessarily wrong, but without defining the terms properly. It is almost without thinking out how they fit in the system. Previously, there'd been a safety valve. There was a safety valve in 75 when we voted to stay in the then European Community. They were an affirmatory thing in Scotland, narrowly in Wales, in 97. And then later in London with the London Mayor. But no one has really fitted when it's so close.
So you don't think that plebiscitary democracy undermines representative democracy? You think it can go hand in hand, but it depends upon the context?
If it's taken too far, it undermines it. Because the essence of representative democracy is a bundling, that you have trade-offs. How are you going to work out the balance between tax and spending? And ultimately, I don't see a better system of representative democracy of doing that. I think there are some fundamental constitutional issues where a referendum is probably right. I mean, being part of the United Kingdom Union, I think it's absolutely right to have one in Scotland, and the two in Scotland we had in 79 and then 97. Equally, if Scotland at any stage wants to leave, you need a repeat of 2014, and that because that's the fundamental decision. Partly cuts across party, but I think it's absolutely right that more people involved. I think the problem with the European one was defining the terms, and that's led to the bitterness and everything else. I think that's the great problem of that, and perfectly reasonable people who are each other's throats as a result.
Do you think then that the experience that we're having with plebiscitary democracy will mean that we'll have less of it in the future, we'll have more of it in the future, or that we'll just have to deal with it in a different way? And if so, then how do we deal with it in a different way?
I mean, I hesitate to say post-Brexit. I don't mean whatever happens on October 31st or whether we're in or out, but what I mean is when we're past the Brexit argument. I think we'll be considerably older probably, but it's when we can look back on it and then reflect on it. I think that it still will have referendums, but better thought out in terms of the way they're run, the way they're structured, the way the questions are asked. I mean, Scotland was in a sense straightforward, because either you were in the Union, it did beg lots of questions. If it had gone yes in 2014, all the questions about currency and all that, which had been fudged by Alex Salmond at the time, but in fact to be addressed, it would have been very difficult. But I think they will still be there, but I think there'll be a marked reluctance, insofar as we have still the same party structures now, and who knows, to go into them as a regular part of politics, because we've seen what's happened in the last 3 years.
You talked about or touched on your work as a journalist. Yeah. I just wanted to bring you back to that. You wrote in 2006 that political journalism can be saved.
Yeah.
Was it?
I think it still exists, and there's still some very good people writing in various forums. I mean, I think one thing which I've never bought the distinction between deadwood media, mainstream media, whatever you like to call it, and exciting, new, vibrant media. I think both coexist. And indeed, even at the end of my period as a journalist, which is now 9 years ago, it being active in social media was becoming part of mainstream journalists' responsibilities. I think it could be saved, but it's not saying, we just stick to print or whatever. It means being adaptable, but it also means preserving some of the values of not being propagandist. I think one of the things which, again, it's a result of Brexit, it has produced a kind of propagandist journalism on both sides. I mean, it's both sides. I mean, of justifying and of being sucked in. And what it's made much harder to do is a more detached, analytical approach. And in fact, saying the pluses and minuses of any position. I mean, it's very solid and clear cut, and that's become harder. And I think that has become harder. It isn't partisan necessarily in the party sense, because that's party structures are so under challenge at present. It has become partisan in relation to Brexit, and you're either supporting us or you're not. And I think that has been unhealthy for journalists, but still some very good journalists around. I mean, people I respect and read, but not necessarily in newspapers, but often online. And I think that's one of the virtues of the broader internet and social media. It has allowed new entrants. I mean, it has produced what people thought it would do, but it's also had the downside of unattributable staff, people getting involved in personal things.
But do you think that the rise of social media and these other platforms, these other ways of consuming news, has sort of forced, at least say, the traditional news media into a position where it sort of has to polarise itself to try and corner more of them, or to hold off some of the market?
Yeah, I'm not convinced of that. I mean, there's a classic retort of people outside journalism, oh, that sensational story will boost sales. Well, very seldom does, actually. I mean, the correlation between, events can boost sales. I mean, 9/11, Princess died, death, whatever, can. I don't think necessarily coverage can. I think what it does do is make it harder for people to say, hold on. The real challenge, and it applies to politicians as well, in a couple of books I've written, I make this point, they've lost the benefit of time. The great thing in the past, and it could be a bad thing as well, but the positive thing was people had time to reflect. They didn't have to react immediately. Now you have to react immediately. You know, why is there a response? Why isn't there that? And the same is true of journalism, that you've got to have your instant story out. Now, that used to be the kind of wire services. You know, we got the interest rate before you did by a millisecond, and that made us a lot of money. Well, that's that world. But it doesn't allow you time to reflect, to check. So it does result in an exaggerated response some of the time, rather than saying, standing back, talking to other people. And when I was a political journalist starting out, I mean, I had one plus deadlines a day, basically at 6:30, 7 o'clock. So during the course of the day, I could talk to people. Nowadays, my successors would have done two or three online pieces. Now, in fact, most of them are rather good, but there is a tendency to believe that newness is significant. I mean, it's a function of 24-hour news. I mean, I draw a line between 24-hour news and the internet and social media. I mean, it's very much the same phenomenon. Is that because something's happened 5 minutes ago, it's more important than something happened 20 minutes ago? Well, no, not necessarily. And it's very hard to say no, mm-hmm. and to slow things down a bit and to reflect.
On that question of time, do you think it's the responsibility of politicians, or it should be the responsibility of politicians, to essentially say no and try and build in more time into their responses, or do you think that's just a sort of naive dream?
I think it would be very desirable if they did. Very desirable if they could build in more time to reflect, to talk and consider. I mean, it's easier said than done. I mean, it sounds rather pious and all that. Actually, as in most things in life, reflection is quite a good idea. I mean, not a massive amount, but enough to think, what does this matter? How should I respond to that? It's quite interesting in relation to crises of various kind. The most successful people responding are those who find out what's happened first. It sounds funny thing to say, but it's true. If you find out what's happened, you're probably going to get it right, rather than rush into a response. And then you're shown, actually, it's something else that's gone wrong, and people question your integrity and all that. Better to try and hold on. And then when you can show, you're on top of it.
Do you think then that politicians are overburdened?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In what they have to do, in what is expected of them, in what they expect perhaps of themselves with regards to response time.
I think they are. I think they made themselves such in some respect. I mean, the famous anecdotes of Harold Macmillan when he was Prime Minister retiring to Reed Trollope and Jane Austen, and I think it would be a lot better if people created a bit of time in the day to pause and think, instead of which being surrounded by advisors going in and out, saying, oh, you must say this, you must say that, we've got this coming up, that coming up, to try and slow things down. They are overburdened because they're overburdened with expectations, some of which are unrealistic. That's why some people, I mean, whatever you think of his views on Europe, Kenneth Clarke had an appeal because he gave the feeling that he'd actually rather be at Ronnie Scott's or having a pint or whatever, and there was authenticity there. And there are others like that too, who can slow things down and think about things. And I can think of a number of others. I mean, it doesn't particularly matter where it is on the political spectrum, but it's that ability to say, okay, what's going on? Let's think about it. Get people around the table.
So that's a burden then on the politicians themselves as opposed to the system within which they work?
Well, it's very difficult to distinguish the two. Right. It's one which they find it very hard to resist. Okay. Very, very hard to resist. It's quite interesting that prime ministers, I've talked to, this goes back mainly to, two in particular, John Major and Tony Blair, whom I knew well, because I knew them during their rise, during the 80s. And I remember asking them, what was the unexpected thing of being Prime Minister? And there were two things. One was a very specific thing, which was Northern Ireland. It just took up much more time than anyone expected. It's a people business, Northern Ireland. And the second was the succession of decisions being required all the time. That they you get things coming at them from all sides, and to try and slow it down and say, okay, this really matters and this doesn't. That both of them said that was one of the most difficult things. That if you were Chancellor, you only had a few big decisions. But if you're Prime Minister, you have constant decisions. People constantly want to see you. They want your time, and to deal with that is very, very difficult. And that's what makes out. I mean, some people. I mean, classically, Anthony Eden in the past. Can't cope with that and crumple under the pressure. Others can handle it. But that's a real test of that. And that's an extreme example. Secretaries of State, they have far more decisions to take. And also, the outsider's problem is we all think that the crisis which we're focused on is the most important thing in a minister's life. It may or may not be. I remember talking to David Cameron's era, to Ed Llewellyn, and something had come up, and I said, well, isn't it interesting, you were doing five other things that day. And he said, dead right, actually, it was more than five, it was 10. Which, at the time, we thought were equally important. But this thing has created the big hoo-ha in the papers and the big row and all that. But actually, a lot of the others were very important, dealing with other countries, dealing with internal stuff. And the real challenge, I think, for political journalists is to get a sense of proportion of what's actually happening in ministers' lives.
I mean, that takes us on quite nicely to your latest book, 15 Minutes of Power, for which you've interviewed scores of ministers down the years about their time in office and the way in which they got things done or failed to get things done. What was the most surprising thing that you learned?
Comparatively, it'll surprise me because I've been doing it for so long. But what surprised me? I think, actually, even if they'd only been a minister for a year, 18 months, 2 years, their pride in office, the people you just thought sympathy for, not just because they were bad ministers, but because the wheel of fortune had gone against them in many cases, they were on the whole, and perhaps that's an aspect of being an elected politician, fairly philosophical about it. I mean, we did most of the interviews at the Institute for Government about at least 2 months after people had gone. I mean, that has to be a grieving period and so on. And so most of them had put it in perspective. But the interesting thing was that they were proud of what they'd done and just regarded it as, well, that's what happens in life. You know, I may not be there for long, and, you know, I did my bit. So that perhaps surprised me. I mean, I find it very unsatisfactory that the idea you leave someone a job for a very short period of time with the best will in the world, they're not going to master the brief. It's not a matter of changing or imposing on the civil service or anything like that. It's just a matter, it takes time to come up to it. And then there's a big gap between announcing something and it being implemented. And one of the great shocks, and I refer to that in the book, when the Labour Shadow Cabinet had a session pre the 97 election, and Patricia Hewitt, who'd worked for Accenture, the management consultants, lined up lots of managers. And she very freely says that the whole thing was a bit of a mess because the Shadow Cabinet members, many of whom became quite prominent cabinet ministers after the May 1997 election, thought all this was pie in the sky. They thought if they announced something, it would happen without realising you were going to have a white paper, you're going to have legislation, you've got to prepare. Anything significant will take probably 2 or 3 years at least, by which time they won't be in office.
So why is that? Why do we have such a remarkably quick turnaround, it seems? I mean, that's something...
One of the reasons is... I mean, there have been particular factors in the last year or two which have made the whirligig turn... So that's the appropriate metaphor. Turn much, much faster. But discounting that, it's the feeling of... quite unusually in the British system, that being a minister is part of the patronage system, part of the loyalty system. Prime Ministers feel they have to refresh it. I have in the book a wonderful quote from Jonathan Powell, who was Chief of Staff to Tony Blair, saying Tony would have loved to have appointed all Labour MPs as ministers. I think possibly one or two exceptions and the current leader of the Labour Party. But anyway, but there was an element of truth in that, and therefore we had all these unpaid ministers and ancillary ministers, but it's to keep them on board. The dilemma then becomes is you want to give an incentive to people on the back benches, but of course you also annoy ex-ministers who then can then become rebels and so on. So it's also pure accident. I mean, governments are remarkably accident-prone, so the resignations and so on. So it's that. But one of the things I criticise is that they don't, haven't in the past, tried to minimise the collateral impact, the waves. That even if someone's got to go, you can bring someone back who's been an ex-minister. You try and isolate the impact. So the result is, for people who are doing a pretty good job, went after 18 months, and for no, I mean, merely because there was knock-on effects from other things. So that is very unsatisfactory, because it results in the whole learning process starting again. It may not be a big change of policy, but it's just not going to be as clear-cut as in the past. And it has a bad effect on policy. Really bad effect is that ministers know this, and therefore they go more short-termist. They think, what can I make an impact in the next year which will impress the whips, impress the PM, so I'll get promoted, and that, rather than recognise that, you know, if you're doing lasting change in housing, the fact we've had virtually a housing minister a year since 2010 is not good news for housing.
But surely prime ministers realise this. A prime minister wants to get something done, wants to build a legacy. Surely they would recognise this as well. And yet still we have this churn.
Well, two things on that is quite interesting. Some recent prime ministers have only been prime minister or one other cabinet job. If you look back, the last prime minister to have done more than one other cabinet job was John Major. If you go to Tony Blair, had done no cabinet jobs. Gordon Brown had been chancellor. David Cameron had done none. Theresa May had done one, Boris Johnson did one. And that, so they actually have less understanding. And it's quite interesting. Ministers, it doesn't matter what the party is, it's irrelevant. In the book, it's reflected, Tory, Labour, whatever, complain that prime ministers don't understand what it's like being a minister. They think that these are kind of chess pieces, can be moved around at will, without realising what actually happens down in the depths, you know, within the half mile around where we're sitting now, at Westminster, and that you do need a bit more continuity. And it's only those who actually experience that. And the last one, really, was John Major. That's extraordinary, really. We're just talking a very long time ago now, 22 years ago, experienced what being a junior minister was. But the other thing is, they're hit by, you know, scandal. I mean, what I said recently, it's been policy differences and so on. That all means, oh, God, we're going to have a reshuffle, even though realising some of it's counterproductive. But I do criticise almost a frivolity, you know, on key areas. I mean, housing is a particular example. I mean, you may have agreed the policy, but you're not going to have successful implementation if you're constantly shifting the ministers. Equally, internationally, quite interestingly, shifting round ministers dealing with international portfolios, and this is way pre-Brexit, 19th Brexit, is a real contrast to other countries who leave ministers in post for much longer. That's partly also coalitions.
But to say, why is that? Why
do you do that? Well, I mean, I remember I met a group from Germany when I ran the Institute for Government, and I tried to explain to them the concept of reshuffles, and they just didn't understand it. Because for them, all right, there were quite long negotiations at the beginning after an election, after a federal election in September, and they can last up to 2 or 3 months. But once the portfolios have been allocated between the parties, that's it. I mean, there can be changes. I mean, there's recently been change in German Defence Minister, Ursula von der Leyen going to Brussels and so on and so forth. But in general, it sticks with the party and sticks with the person. Mm. And that actually applied at the beginning of the Cameron government. That David Cameron realised this and didn't want to have many reshuffles. Also, the coalition meant that if he wanted to change some people, he had to negotiate with Nick Clegg. So all the cabinet posts stayed. Exactly, the personalities changed a bit on the Lib Dem side and lots on the Tory side. But the allocation didn't, so it slowed things down.
Because we're quite proud of the system of cabinet government in this country, and yet it seems like there are, as you're saying, rather a number of flaws with the way in which it operates, at least. What would you be able to do to sort of improve the problems that you're outlining?
Well, one...
Is it possible?
One frivolous answer is, of course, we've been going through a period without majority governments or without stable majority governments. I mean, the era I well remember of the, you know, massive Thatcher majorities, the Blair majorities, even though that was obviously disturbed by the Iraq War, enabled, although in fact, certainly Blair didn't do it, he fiddled a lot, but enabled a cooler, more rational. The last few years have not been easy for that pair. So my real answer is a government with a stable majority.
Right.
Either a coalition or a single party one. Mm. Only both can work. Secondly, a recognition by the Prime Minister that it's desirable to leave people in post longer. And if you do have vacancies, plug them in different ways. Also say to ministers, I'm appointing you housing minister. Here's 2 or 3 priorities. Don't do too much. Focus on a 3-year timescale, something like that. And we'll leave you and the Secretary of State, if you're Secretary of State or whatever, to get on with it. And so it's realistic timescales for planning and implementation of policy and not moving people around in key posts. I mean, in some posts it matters much less, but in others, just a slowing down the process, and which will affect ministers themselves, which will recognise that they can do things for the longer term. I mean, if you want to achieve real change, it is going to take time, and it's going to take time to implement. And the other thing, which is a kind of very might seem perverse now given the current politics, successful change also ultimately depends on it being accepted by the opposition party. Now, that doesn't necessarily happen initially, but in other areas it does happen. I mean, quite a lot of some of the education changes were also fiercely contested at the time, both under Ken Baker and later some of the stuff under Labour and then under Michael Gove. actually bedded in because there was an implicit agreement on not all of it, but on much of it. Similarly, less true on health, but it was true initially on health. And if you get some cross-party support, or in some way acquiescence, that helps too.
Do you think we're in danger in this current climate of losing that legitimacy of the opposition, that legitimacy of difference?
Yes. I mean, I'm not saying it shouldn't be scrutiny. Of course there should be. And when the main case is there are basic differences, which have now come out, I mean, in politics at present. But it does make it harder to implement changes, particularly in some of the major social policy areas. I mean, one which has been successful is on pensions. Quite a lot of the pension, I'm thinking mainly of the changes in state pension and so on. Some of that has been quite successful embedded in. What happened under Labour was basically accepted by the Tories. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff Steve Webb did in the coalition with Ian Duncan-Smith has been accepted on pensions. Now, there are a lot of pension things which are controversial, but ultimately you've got to project for the long term and try and get support for that, which doesn't mean parties don't have their own views. Of course they do. But it's no good to produce a policy on something as long-term as that, which the opposition then says we're going to scrap.
If you had a magic wand, then, and you were able to do one thing to either to improve the system of governance, to improve the long-term thinking, to try and build this form of consensus that you might have spoken about, what would it be?
I'd have fewer ministers. We have too many. We have far more than most other countries. Now, the difference in the political system, and one of the ironies is, despite privatisation in the 80s and 90s, despite devolution in the 90s and post-2000, we've actually got more ministers than we had before that. I mean, there has been a reduction in ministers dealing with state industries, as they used to be called, fairly obviously, and there's been a reduction in the Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland offices. However, it's been more than compensated by increases elsewhere for patronage reasons. I tighten the screw on that quite. So you couldn't have unpaid ministers, and you enforce the law, the number of paid ministers. And I would say to prime ministers, try and think of it longer term.
Do you think that's possible? Let's hope for that.
It's wishful thinking. I mean, in the current environment, I mean, I say at the end of my book, 50 Minutes of Power, you know, with Brexit overshadowing everything, this is desirable, but I can't claim it's likely to happen. Indeed, there was a cut-off point when I wrote the book in February, and the number of changes between February and the Tory leadership election, and then you've had the whole new government since then, appear to kind of, I mean, these are exceptional circumstances and all that. I'm just hoping that the waves will settle at some stage and people will be able to say, well, what's good government?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.